You're listening to a recording from the Open Society Institute, working to build vibrant and tolerant democracies worldwide. Visit us at soros.org.
Good afternoon. I'm Rob Varenick of the Justice Initiative, and here to present James Stewart and his talk on accountability of those involved in arms sales under international law. James is a professor. He teaches at the University of British Columbia, and before that was at the Appeals Counsel's Office for the prosecutor of the International Tribunal of for the former Yugoslavia, and part of the prosecutorial team at the Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda. Perhaps more salient for our purposes that he has also, over the last about 2.5 years, played an extraordinarily innovative and constructive role with OSI, in particular the Justice Initiative, in acting as the kind of intellectual leader of something called the Pillage Project, which started almost by chance running into Jim and then subsequently coming to our offices in 2007 to describe how a centuries-old doctrine called pillage that everybody knows of, but no one knows exactly what it is under law, could be used to address some of the most modern and atrocious crimes known to the 20th and 21st centuries. And I just would like to say that I think it is that experience really underlined what I think is one of James's great talents, which is finding legal potential hiding in plain sight. Where others have passed over, he has decided to land and develop, and I think he is on the verge of doing the same thing in his capacity as an OSI fellow with regard to accomplice liability for crimes committed as a result of arms transfers. So to give maximum time to James and then to you for exchange, I'll just turn it over to him with a welcome and thanks.
Thanks very much, Robin. Thank you all for coming. I want to talk to you today about accomplice liability for international crimes and specifically focusing on the arms trade and weapons transfers. I think I have about 20 minutes, so I want to tell you where I'm going and what I'm going to tell you before I get there so you don't get too lost. I want to start by providing you a narrative about how this project came up. Rob kindly mentioned that I have a past of discovering things that are in plain sight, but there is a reason why I've been doing that, and I think it helps for you to understand where this comes from. Having gone through the narrative, I want to give you a short overview of the types of things that I'm going to be looking at as a fellow within this research over the next 18 months. So it's sort of a research overview in fairly concrete terms. Then I want to finish by highlighting for you some of what I think are the added values of looking at arms transfers through the lens of international criminal liability and complicity in particular. Excuse me. So let me start with the narrative. I first became interested in these sorts of ideas about 10 years ago, slightly less, when I was working as part of a prosecution team for the International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda. And there were many interesting experiences and difficult experiences in that role. But one of them was that I saw what was happening just across the border in the Democratic Republic of Congo as a continuation of the Rwandan genocide. Not, of course, just in terms of a physical continuation of the violence, which was just moved across the border, but more insidiously, a continuation of the same type of Western indifference that had tolerated the Rwandan genocide. And so, for my sins, I resolved at the time that the Democratic Republic of Congo would feature as a central part of my ongoing work. So I followed with interest the establishment by the United Nations Security Council of a panel of experts charged with investigating the illegal exploitation of natural resources. And the last of these reports over the course of 3 years, excuse me, highlighted what I describe as a vicious triangle. If you go to the report, you'll see the diagram of the triangle, and it looks like this. At the apex of the triangle is continuation of armed violence characterized by egregious human rights violations. In the bottom right-hand corner, there is illegal exploitation of natural resources, and on the other corner is illicit arms trafficking. And each of these flows into the other, creating a downward spiral into darkness, which meant that the Congo and other resource wars become self-sustaining war economies that create win-win situations for belligerents, but terrible, intractable violence for civilians. And it struck me, I was then working as a prosecutor in The Hague, for the former Yugoslavia, and it struck me about my own discipline at the time, you know, international criminal justice focuses too much on the apex of the triangle. We as prosecutors, we wait till violence has run its course, and then we mop up and we prosecute murder and torture and rape and so on and so forth. Much better, no, to prosecute businesses involved in illegally exploiting natural resources or businesses involved in selling weapons to notoriously brutal regimes before all of this violence unravels completely. Why not be interventionist and go after companies involved in the two bottom corners of the triangle? And that really explains first how I came to start thinking about pillage of natural resources and the work that's recently been completed with OSJI. And now, this is the first week actually, of looking at the second corner of that triangle, which is accomplice liability of arms vendors. Now, over the course of the next 18 months, I will produce a manual or a primer, is I think a better term for this, that will be given to war crimes prosecutors, both international and domestic. It will be given to investigators from United Nations panels of experts and to the NGO community, that highlights the relationship between complicity, arms transfers, and international crimes. And hopefully, in doing this, it's a response, obviously, to the events in the Democratic Republic of Congo, but also a template that is relevant for arms transfers in all other contexts, too. So that is the brief narrative, the brief overview of how I came to be looking at these types of issues. I want to move on now to the second part and talk to you a little bit about the parameters of this research. I want to give you a snapshot of some of the things that I'm thinking about, and then we can move on later and talk about the implications of this. So there are four central questions in the research that I'm looking at, and I'll unpack them in a moment, but here is what they are. What is complicity? What does complicity mean? Which international crimes? Of course, we all know that international crimes means war crimes, crimes against humanity, and genocide. But of course, those are broad categories. I mean, war crimes can mean killing civilians, obviously, but it can also mean unlawful confinement or deportation or a whole range of other things. Likewise, crimes against humanity are varied, torture, and so on and so forth. So really, the potential is that arms vendors can become complicit in many different types of international crimes, and part of my function is to say which international crimes are most relevant and how do they intersect with the types of arms transfers that we will be looking at. That, of course, brings us to the next question, which weapons? I mean, there are an enormous variety of weapons. The tendency is to focus a little bit on small arms because small arms tend to flood the types of conflicts that we have seen since the end of the Cold War. But my interest at the very beginning of this research is much broader. I am interested in all weapons. So ammunition, I'm very interested in ammunition. I'm very interested in small arms. I am interested in cluster munitions. I'm interested in landmines. I'm interested in nuclear weapons. The door is wide open at the start, and as you'll see in a minute, I don't think this breadth is maintainable, but at the beginning I'm going to sponge in as much as I can and make some decisions about focusing this slightly more. So we've seen what is complicity, which international crimes, which weapons. The last question is which perpetrators? And again, I'm thinking specifically in the context of arms vendors. And here my focus is potentially on arms manufacturers, arms vendors, and arms distributors. We'll see the consequences of that in a moment. Let me say a little bit more about each of those four things. So, first, complicity. I start with and apologies to people who have heard this before, but I start with a very simple illustration from domestic criminal law. If I sell Rob a weapon, knowing that he is going to use the weapon to kill Steve, I become... People always think, oh, do you have to use real people? It's kind of macabre. especially these people. It serves a purpose. Anyway, so I become complicit in the murder. What I'm proposing doing is elevating that principle from domestic criminal law onto an international plane and then extrapolating across the arms trade generally. It's not all that novel what I'm proposing to do. At the end of the Second World War, for instance, the people, the businessmen who supplied the Nazis with the chemical Zyklon B, which was used as an asphyxiant, were prosecuted for complicity in the extermination that resulted. But more recently, in the last 5 to 10 years, the Dutch have prosecuted two of their own businessmen. One, a gentleman, if you'll excuse the phrase, Van Anrant, who was prosecuted and convicted of war crimes for supplying chemical precursors for mustard gas to Saddam Hussein that was ultimately visited upon Iraqi Kurds and within Iran. Likewise, the Dutch prosecuted their businessman, Kouwenhoven, for, among other things, selling weapons to Charles Taylor in Liberia. That case is still ongoing, and it resulted in an acquittal initially, but it's been sent back by the Supreme Court, and there is more we could say about both of those cases. I guess what I'm trying to emphasize, though, is that this model, this extrapolation onto the international plane for arms vendors is not particularly new. All I'm doing is saying, well, these cases are very, very interesting, but what do they say about all arms transfers and all international crimes? What does this add? There is a great deal of technicality about what complicity means, and I will give you the shortest version in history now. There are two requirements. One is causation. One is knowledge, at least knowledge. Causation means that a prosecutor will have to prove that the weapon I sold Rob was the one used to kill Steve. It's easy in this three-way relationship. It's much more complicated when Kouwenhoven sells weapons to Charles Taylor, who has many of his own weapons, and you have to say, okay, well, you sold a series of guns to Charles Taylor, but can you prove that those guns were the ones used to commit rape and murder and so on and so forth? So that is one element, causation. That requires me to be looking into all of the forensic expertise on tracing of weapons of all varieties, ammunition, small arms, and so on and so forth. The other aspect is knowledge, or in some instances, purpose. I'm not going to dwell on this, but suffice to say that at least I have to know in selling Rob the weapon that he will use it to kill someone. It's not sufficient if I just sell him a weapon and I know nothing and he kills someone. I don't become liable for the subsequent crime. So there were two essential elements that I'm thinking about. That's the short version. Let me bring together two of the questions that I highlight, of the four questions that I highlighted at the beginning. What crimes and what weapons? Let me bring them together to say some of the things that I'm interested in. So everyone thinks intuitively and rightly when they think about the relationship between international crimes and weapons, they think of murder. And that will feature as a central part of my analysis, obviously. But I think there are more nuanced relationships that are potentially very, very important. One of which is the relationship, say, between, on the one hand, small arms proliferation and small arms sales, and on the other, rape. I won't say more about it now because it's one of the things that I want to use as an example in the next section of my talk on implications of this. But think more broadly. What about use of child soldiers, which is a war crime now? Who's supplying them ammunition? How are they getting weapons? These are the sorts of questions that I hope to flesh out more. There are further questions about illegal detention as a war crime and the type of weapons that are used to sustain that regime and so on and so forth. So those are the types of what I describe as human rights type international crimes. But beyond the human rights type international crimes, you have conduct of hostilities crimes. So suddenly you think, well, what about use of cluster munitions in populated areas in, say, Lebanon? We hear about the political controversies about these weapons being used, but does anyone think about the weapons producers themselves? What did they know about the production of these weapons, what was involved in the sale of these weapons. Likewise, landmines. These are indiscriminate weapons. Indiscriminate attack on civilians is a war crime. What are the relationships between complicity, corporate liability as vendors, and these ultimate crimes for conduct of hostilities? Finally, along those similar sorts of lines, what about nuclear weapons? I mean, there's been a lot said about the relationship between international law and nuclear weapons, but nothing about the relationship between international criminal law and nuclear weapons. What are the implications of this relationship? So, I think from this quick snapshot, you get a view, you get an understanding that my focus at the very beginning of this is very, very broad. It looks at all weapons. It looks at all types of perpetrators, from manufacturer to distributor. It looks at all international crimes, which are many, and it's not even limited in terms of time. So it's both contemporary transfers and potentially historical. That process will most certainly be narrowed, and if you have ideas about that, I would be very interested in hearing your input about transfers that you think are particularly problematic and relationships between weapons and international crimes that are most pressing. So please consider this an invitation to dialogue. I'll be working on this for 18 months, and this is my first week, so it's for the next few months a process of exploration. Let me finish by talking a little bit about what I see as the added value and the implications of this analysis, and I'm going to talk specifically about the arms trade. There are a whole series of broader implications that I'm happy to talk to by way of question if you're interested about how this affects and changes other disciplines that you might be involved in, such as international criminal justice, transitional justice, responsibility to protect, corporate social responsibility. There are broad implications along those lines, but I'm not going to mention those now, because what I want to focus on is really the implications for the arms trade specifically. Now, the first implication, I think, is that this analysis promises potentially to give arms embargoes teeth. Now, traditionally, the ways in which the international community and states regulated flows of weapons to conflict zones and to notoriously brutal regimes was to impose an arms embargo, either by the Security Council, regional entities like the EU, or state itself like the United States. But all of the literature and all of the review suggests that arms embargoes are at best ineffective, and in many instances actually exacerbate violence. We can talk more about that dynamic if you like. For me, one of the even more telling things about the inefficacy of arms embargoes is that there are almost no instances of violators of arms embargoes being held accountable legally. I've heard that there are maybe a handful, but I have a team of four people researching for me who can find none. As I say, it's the first week. Let's see what comes up. But I think there's broad recognition that arms embargoes are salutary. They don't actually have any binding legal consequences in many instances. And so one of the added values of this research, of looking at this problematic of arms transfers to conflict zones, is to highlight the pre-existing value of international criminal law that couples with courts, both international and domestic, that have jurisdiction over these types of crimes and that create real and tangible political pressures to initiate prosecutions, which I think will do much more than arms embargoes in the past. The second aspect is its contribution to what is an ongoing process of negotiation for a multilateral treaty on the arms trade, also known as the ATT, the Arms Trade Treaty. And this is a very noble endeavor, and it will have, I think, positive consequences in a number of realms. We see Hillary Clinton recently professing allegiance to this process, and the first PrepComs are in July here in New York. Potentially the idea is to have a signed treaty in 2012 that establishes uniform export standards across the world. Part of the problem with this is that countries like Jordan hold themselves out and say, hey, arms manufacturers, come to Jordan. We have no export controls. Therefore, it creates sorts of races to the bottom and a lack of real regulatory effect. One of the central features of the arms trade treaty is that an attempt to make human rights records or law of war records of end users relevant to the legality of the transfer, which, as I say, I think is noble. What it ignores, though, is that the human rights record or law of war record of recipients is already relevant under a complicity analysis. It already exists. So what I'm trying to highlight is that this project already contributes something which is a central feature of the arms trade treaty. Not only that, it's very difficult to imagine states agreeing to have more robust enforcement of violations of this principle. So one of the added values of this research says you don't have to agree, it already exists. It's domestic criminal law and international criminal law. So there's a potential that this analysis will hopefully positively contribute to the types of negotiations that we'll see here in New York over the next few years. Let me say a last word about what I think is potentially one of the more exciting aspects of this research, and I allude back to my rape example earlier. It's really that the ability of a complicity analysis and its focus on arms vendors to create real incentives for warring parties to observe the laws of war. Now, to return to the Congo, I use as an example of this systematic rape in the Congo, but you could use a number of other human rights type violation examples, both by rebel groups or by established armies. But let's focus just for a minute on systematic rape in the Democratic Republic of Congo. Now, this rape is perpetrated predominantly by rebel groups, but also by the National Army at times. The difficulty focusing on the rebel groups, the difficulty is that it's very difficult to create incentives for rebels to observe the laws of war. So all of the literature sees this as a real problem. Rebels are already operating outside the law. They are already criminals within their domestic system for treason or something like that, or equivalents. So adding new layers of criminal obligation for rebel groups is often unhelpful. It often adds no greater degree of incentive. And so it's within the literature on these sorts of things, it's a real problem about creating incentives for rebel groups to observe laws of war, and rape in the Congo is an example par excellence. One of the things I'm excited about this research is that it potentially links the rebels' military strategy to the need to observe the laws of war. And it does it in this way. You are effectively saying to the rebel group, if you continue raping, you will not get weapons, you will lose the war. Now, there are many people interested in dealing with systematic rape, and we see Hillary Clinton flying to the Congo to make at least some public political contribution to the problem, but there are, from what I've read so far, few really novel attempts to try and deal with the problem and curb it from the very start. And at the beginning stages, I'm excited about the potential for this project to actually have some incentive along those lines. So that then is probably all I should say as a snapshot. There is, as I say, much, much more to say about how all of this research is situated within ideas about transitional justice, responsibility to protect, corporate social responsibility, and so on and so forth. I am happy to answer questions along those lines if you have them, but please, as I say, take this as an introduction and an invitation to collaborate and to share ideas along these lines. I'd love to work with you over the next little while. Thanks.
So we can open it up.
Get two microphones coming.
Yeah, that'd be great. Hi, I'm Abby Schwartz with the Southeast Asia Initiative. I'm not quite sure how to phrase this question, but I'm curious to know how you see the complicity doctrine fitting in with command and control. Because let's say an arms dealer deals to a general who's whose weapons then make their way down the line, and by virtue of command and control doctrine, then he becomes responsible because he knew or should have known what his subordinates were doing. Does that by extension carry over to the ammunition dealers or, you know, the arms dealers? Is that clear?
Yeah.
Do you want me to answer them?
I was just wondering if you could describe a typical arms trade chain that would lead you into the Congo, because my impression with U.S. arms exports, and it may be wrong, it's only an impression that I got through looking at the pending treaties with the U.K. and Australia, but, you know, as I understand it, there's significant controls on arms exports from the United States to particular countries, and those controls include looking at where those arms go after they reach their end point at the country. So I would assume that in order to get into the hands of rebel groups, those arms would be transferred from the U.S. to the first destination where we have a particular control, and then from that company to another destination in Africa. I just wonder how the complicity makes its way up the chain to the first country that or the company in the U.S. that respected the national level control.
Hi, James. Sandy Colliver. I'm interested in if you've looked at what countries, what forums you think might be most attractive for looking at prosecutions, and also if you've had conversations with the ICC prosecutor or staff, how receptive they are, and maybe just briefly to look at the issue that surfaced in Italy, where a prosecutor tried to prosecute for armed sanctions violations, and the case was thrown out by the Supreme Court, I think, because of saying that there were insufficient contacts with Italy.
Why don't we try one more, and then we'll...
Hi, Erica Rizouk, Justice Initiative. I think the arms trade is a really interesting example for looking at corporate liability, especially with regards to complicity, because for a long time, I think the sort of the business and human rights community has been struggling with this idea of complicity, but it seems like with arms dealers, there's it might be a little bit easier to make the case, and I'm curious as to your thoughts on this, because if you compare a company like Caterpillar that produces a bulldozer and sells it to a state, you know, you don't know if that's going to be used to illegally destroy a house or, you know, in legitimate construction projects. But if you're selling ammunition or other weapons, it just seems like there would be a heightened standard, or rather easier to get over that knowledge hurdle, just because the products themselves, you know, lend themselves so easily to wrongful killing. So I'm just wondering if you could talk about any jurisprudence either at the international or, you know, domestic criminal level on that knowledge standard when the product itself is so closely tied to crimes and abuses.
So let me try and respond to those, otherwise my 10 megabyte brain will be over full. Excellent questions. The first question, the first two questions I think are actually similar questions, if I'm right. The first two questions are about questions of chains of custody and the flows of weapons and how they come into conflicts. Let me say a number of things. First, that's a problem. It's a problem because if you take my three-way example here, I have to prove causation, I have to prove that the weapons that I sold were used in the international crime. Now, if you take a three-way example here with three guys and you have one weapon and, you know, wow, it's the weapon I sold is exactly the one used and there's no doubt that that was the one used, that's easy. But when you start introducing middlemen, vendors, it becomes more complicated. It becomes more complicated but not impossible, which is why I say I am now looking at all of the technology and all of the forensic science around tracing weapons back from shell cartridges in a mass grave to manufacturers and end producers. In addition to that, I think there is a sort of a matrix that I'm looking at. So when I say I'm looking at distributors, manufacturers, and perpetrators, it may be that you cannot tie it to the manufacturer. It may be that you cannot tie it even to the vendor, to the foreign state, but maybe you can find the distributor who's responsible, and that will send a similar message to rebel groups who are systematically raping. The last aspect, I think, of your question, Abby, was about command and control. So my sense is that those two things might be separate issues. So you will not have an arms company that is in command and control of the perpetrators. You will only potentially have a general who is. So complicity just will disregard the command and control issue and just go straight through whatever you can prove causation and knowledge with. It may be that you can hold the commander responsible through superior responsibility for similar sorts of acts, but that's not quite, I think, my focus. I should, to the second question and to what I've already said, I should have added one more factor of my focus at the very beginning. Arms transfers are generally divided between lawful transfers, which means transfers that have the blessing of the state, in this country, the United States government, gray zone, which are partially legal but not fully legal, and then illicit transfers. I am looking at all of them, which again is too broad and will probably be something that I have to refine. But at this stage, I am looking at arms smuggling from Uganda to the DRC or elsewhere, and I am looking at Cold War transfers by Russia and the United States to Nicaragua and Angola. So I am looking at a broad range of transfers at this early stage, and potentially those create new opportunities also for focusing on where you might be able to isolate complicity. I should also say that part of my process is being very honest about what will and will not work. So in some instances, if chains are just so complex, then I will be putting up my hand saying, because of the sophistication of this particular chain, this becomes a problem because it means you can't trace causal links into the final crime. So I'm going to also be very honest about the limitations of this analysis for liability. I don't see it as a panacea for all arms transfers at all. Sandy, the question about fora for prosecuting these crimes. The first aspect of your question, I think, is what is the best legal forum for these prosecutions? And I think there's something very exciting happening in international criminal justice at the moment, and I think it's something that we should be promoting as much as we can, which is what I call prosecution of own nationals. So it's use of extraterritorial jurisdiction to go after Van Anrant for perpetrating crimes in Iraq, or go after Cowan Hoven for perpetrating crimes in Liberia. I think it's most exciting because it's a departure from the old victor's justice idea of international criminal justice, when states say, you know what, our nationals will not be doing this overseas. So for me, this, and it reduces all of the conflict around universal jurisdiction, it eliminates all of the US concerns about ICC jurisdiction. I think it's something we should be pushing hard for, is active personality jurisdiction over our own corporate actors. And in a way, I mean, I've just been in DC and had some very fruitful conversations with your colleagues in DC. And in a way, that shouldn't seem too controversial. I mean, even in the United States, there's a long history of holding corporations like Enron and Arthur Andersen accountable for major violations of criminal law. This is a relatively minor, arguably a relatively minor transition into international law. The second aspect of your question, I think, is the ICC interested? About 2 or 3 years ago, I presented pillage work to the ICC, and they have a specific unit that's focused on arms transfers. How to put this politely, I'm not quite sure what they're doing at the moment in terms of I see in terms of arms transfers within their cases, but I know they're very interested in, and I think they should be. The last question is about the prosecution in Italy. I think it's, is it the Russian Minin, who is like Victor Bout's collaborator? That story, I don't know it especially well, but that story is, I think, from what little I do know about it, a fairly egregious miscarriage of justice. I think Minin was discovered with several hundred thousand dollars of Sierra Leone diamonds on his person and prostitutes from eight countries. And there was something deeply political about the way the prosecution went away. From what I know, it's I don't know enough about it to say particularly much, except that my sense is that it's not a particularly good precedent. Let me move on to the fourth question, which is, I think, about Caterpillar ammunition and standards of knowledge. So, Erica, I think, where to start here? One of the real contributions and I think exciting avenues for civil society about this research is that they can put arms vendors on notice themselves. So what you do, and this is what happened in the Caterpillar litigation, which is where Caterpillar is supplying bulldozers to the Israeli army, which are converted into sort of bulldozers that achieve home demolitions. And what happens, I forget which NGO it is, maybe someone else knows, but writes letters to Caterpillar and say, you know what, your bulldozers are being used to perpetrate international crimes. And then they continue to use them to perpetrate international crimes. And so what you say is, well, listen, we know you knew because we told you. So this creates essentially an industry for NGOs to be monitoring arms transfers much more closely and to be saying to the Lockheed Martins and Boeings of the world, hey, you know that arms transfer that you made of attack helicopters? It was used to kill 15,000 civilians in Sierra Leone. Stop doing it. Or here are the potential consequences. Your question, though, was specific about the nature of the products sold. And I think here, and you highlight ammunition as an example, there are implications for the type of weapon. Ammunition is a difficult one because, of course, the first thing that people say, and this is what happened in the Cowenhoven case, the courts just said, well, listen, you know, sure, the guy sold weapons to Charles Taylor, but Charles Taylor could have used the weapons for perfectly legitimate reasons like self-defense or legitimate military operations. You have to prove that that ammunition was used to commit an international crime. And there's nothing, in the parlance of the arms trade, there's nothing bad about weapons as such. I'm not in the process of taking down the entire weapons market, which is unrealistic. In the extreme. So ammunition is quite problematic, actually. What becomes easier are things like chemical weapons, because, for instance, in the Van Anrant trial, you know, the court just said, listen, there is no commercial application for chemical weapons in this quantity other than chemical weapons. So you knew, right? Because you're supplying such a huge quantity of mustard gas to a country in war with Iran. You must have known, you're an expert in these chemicals, that the only application of this quantity of precursor is warfare weaponry. Nuclear weapons might demonstrate similar sorts of evidential consequences. But in each instance, you will have to prove the knowledge or the higher standard quite carefully and with quite careful evidence.
Ready for round two?
Sure, I think.
Anyone else?
Yes, Cornelius Goldner from the Central Eurasia Project. we run a project, a kind of exploratory project that looks at Western military and secure cooperation with Central Asia and the implications for local democratic governance and economy. and those kind of things. The question that I have, and part of this is touching back to the Caterpillar issue, and it's basically about the scope of your research. First, are those kind of like dual-use goods, I mean, you mentioned Caterpillar, the example that comes to my mind are Land Rovers that were produced in or under license in Turkey and sold to the Uzbek regime, turned up in the killings in Andijan, were used to ferry around Uzbek forces. Is that also going to be part of your research? And the second question, also issues like training agreements between states, those kind of things, or train and equip programs with police forces. Are these things going to be featured in your research at all? Thanks.
I guess I had two questions. One is, I was at a conference last week where there was a little bit of a debate about the impact of international criminal justice, and one of the sort of intentionally provocative questions that that a speaker raised was essentially a critique of what he thought was a double standard or hypocrisy on the part of advocates of criminal international criminal justice. He says most of whom would say in the domestic context structural causes of crime are how you explain that crime happens, and so the deterrence theory doesn't really work. You know, you can do what you want about defining new crimes and raising the chances of or the punishment levels, but that's really not going to deter people from committing crimes. And domestically, many criminologists and rights advocates think that. But when it comes to international criminal law, all of a sudden everybody's a rational actor, and so you know. Put a couple of people, a handful of people, on trial at the ICC, and somehow that's going to, you know, deter conflict. So I guess one is how you would respond to that in the context of these actors and the potential kind of defendant community. And the second, just to be completely unfair to you, is based on, and maybe you answered this in part, or you hinted at your answer in response to the question on types of arms, but based on what you know about the law so far, transfers, conflicts, and fora, where would you predict the first sort of successful post-James Stewart fellowship prosecution will take place?
Hi, Steve Hubble from the Open Society Fellowship Program. James, I was wondering if you had studied the aftermath of the passage of the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act here. Obviously, that was an effort to criminalize the paying of bribes to foreign officials in order to, facilitate, trade and petroleum and other commodities like that. The passage of the law called into existence a whole stratum of middlemen and fixers whose job it was to pay those bribes and then to conclude the contracts with governments on both sides. So there was a kind of chess game involved. The passage of the act occasioned this new generation of fixers. I'm not aware of what was done in response to that. I'm sort of interested in the response to their response, because if there is, if you are successful on some level, there will certainly be efforts to cloud the chain of causality and the chain of complicity. And I'm wondering how you would see, and this is speaking hypothetically, but how you would see the response to those reactions.
So the first question about first dual-use goods and training programs. I think at this stage, dual-use goods are in. They're in simply because at this stage I'm hoping to keep as an open mind. While I do all of the reading, I'm still very much familiarizing myself with the landscape and of arms transfers generally. So dual-use goods are most definitely in it. Although training programs are very important, I think I'm going to exclude them because my category is already too large and I'm conscious of that. But in terms of dual-use goods, and we can talk about Caterpillar or any other type of good that has a commercial application that can be transferred into a military, it doesn't present any real trouble for a complicity analysis in and of itself. It's the same type of analysis. Was the bulldozer used to commit an international crime, and did the manufacturer know that it would be used to
to commit an international crime. And of course, with dual use products, the manufacturer can say, well, we thought it would have a we thought it would have a commercial application, not a military application, but that's just a question of evidence and something that NGOs and others can help in disproving. Question, two questions from Rob. The first about deterrence, and I think I've glossed over some of a range of other things which are slightly more important to me with my academic cap on. But I think one of the real advantages of focusing on corporations is that all evidence suggests that they are much more likely to be deterred than rebel groups or armies. All suggestions are that corporations are much more rational than rebel groups, for instance, and much more responsive to the threat of criminal sanction than rebel groups. So I think one of the advantages, for instance, if you're going after systematic rape in the Congo, one of the advantages of focusing on complicity of arms vendors is that it is likely to have much more appreciable consequences than rebels. So I think that is part of the argument that I'm trying to put forward in a slightly more academic context. First, prosecutions. Well, it's difficult to anticipate where first prosecutions are, because to be perfectly honest, I'm not actually familiar with who the people are and which are the really prime cases at this early stage. I know Amnesty just sent me some information. They wrote a letter to the Thai authorities suggesting that Victor Bout should be prosecuted for complicity in international crimes. And intuitively, I would say, from the fact that he's been named in almost every UN panel of experts as violating arms embargoes, that he would be a prime contender. Minin, the person in Italy, I think is also almost as bad or almost as infamous in terms of featuring in UN panels of experts. It's difficult to say, but I personally would really be focusing on domestic prosecution of own nationals, and in that regard I would be focusing on the P5, which are the biggest arms producers, and probably France, Germany, United States, Britain. You may want to focus more seriously on countries that have an established culture of prosecuting international crimes and their own, like the Netherlands, Canada, and so on and so forth. But I think it's probably a little premature for me to answer, having not seen where I think the biggest pockets of offending are.
We're going to ask you again at the end. So.
I don't doubt that, Rob. I don't doubt that. The question about the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act. So, if I understand, Steve, your analogy to the act is one where you suggest that the commercial reaction was to create a whole series of new middlemen that were an attempt to defeat or diffuse responsibility for liability. And how do I anticipate that happening in this instance too? At this early stage, I don't want to place too much emphasis on forensics, but I do think they are quite exciting. I worked on a case in Srebrenica in the former Yugoslavia, and it's quite astonishing what can be proved from an ammunition shell found in a mass grave. It's quite astonishing also what can be proved and what intelligence services know about a missile fired almost anywhere now. And so what I'm excited about the project for is that it enables people to work backwards from the crime, tracing arms backwards. Most of what's known about tracing weapons now is tracing them forwards. So most of the experts know about controls from within the United States, about where arms go from there and how do we control them. But there is less recognition, less experience with bringing together a group of international experts who know about satellite imagery, about tracing weapons numbers, about ammunition shell casings and so on and so forth, and working backwards towards manufacturer. That doesn't really solve, though, the knowledge aspect. But as I say, I do think there's a real opportunity for people to be much more proactive in doing the types of monitoring and informing companies about what's happening with their weapons, so that there's no plausible deniability on that front. How do I see the industry responding to this? To be honest, I think the biggest threat is not so much about new strategies against new strategies to circumvent this liability. I think the bigger danger is a pushback against international criminal justice generally, which is precisely why I try and emphasize that it should be national prosecutors prosecuting their own, and that we should be doing as much as we possibly can to foster a culture where that is possible, and to build on the fact that the British are now prosecuting their soldiers for war crimes in Iraq, and the Dutch are prosecuting their businessmen, and that's really a development that I think we shouldn't understate.
Program. Can you just continue a little more on that current train of thought? Like, just to understand in the broad scheme of things, take the U.S. for example. I mean, you would think that the arms producing companies in this country would have all sorts of systems in place to make sure that what you're working on never can get back to them. So, I mean, what kind of fortress have they built? And I mean, do you see cracks in that fortress, so to speak? And to what extent, I mean, you mentioned the P5 being the largest manufacturer, so, I mean, one would assume somewhere in that chain on either direction that, I mean, something falls apart, and you had even mentioned earlier that maybe the chain is too murky to even kind of figure your way out of it. And forgive me, I cannot remember if I read this or from whom I heard it, but are you familiar with this maybe case with Guinea and the British government and some other in the massacre that happened in September and some sort of agreement between the British government and the Guinean government over arms and trying to do, it sounds like maybe something similar to what you're getting at, and I'm just wondering if you can explain that, if you're familiar with that example.
I wonder if you could just say more about the U.S., where it stands in this. I understand that the Department of Defense has just created a new office on human rights and humanitarian law, and I think partly provoked by the Victor Boot situation of DOD having given contracts to him to fly equipment into Afghanistan and Iraq, et cetera. Possibly related to this is a question about the financiers. Will you be looking at financiers? And part of my question there is, I think also that, for instance, Treasury will underwrite some companies that go in and providing credits for them to get credit lines. This was something that the Dutch were looking at as well. In Belgium, George Forrest for his Bank of Congo was getting a loan credit. So I wonder if that's within your purview.
Mm-hmm. Two excellent questions, and I think the themes flow well between the two of them. I wanted to emphasize, though, and probably I haven't done this sufficiently at this point, I haven't emphasized the problems with this sufficiently. And I think the problems are significant, and probably we shouldn't lose sight of them, that they are significant because what I'm talking about is extrapolating a criminal law onto an international stage. But, of course, we don't really have a system of global governance that can allow, that is hierarchical. You know, we have states, and some of them are very powerful, and they are resistant to application of international criminal justice, and that produces, I think, real problems. Let me start with the question of the P5. Well, China is a problem for me. I mean, the United States is a problem too, and I'll get to it in a moment. But China is a problem, and maybe more of a problem, because China is supplying Mugabe. China is supplying Sudan. And one of the difficulties with that is China also seems particularly impervious to the application of international criminal law at the moment. I don't attempt to apologize for that problem. It is a major problem, and it is something that I will be thinking about carefully together with people here and elsewhere that know a great deal about China. The U.S. is also similar in the sense that you ask questions about what the companies have the fortress companies have built. And my sense is the fortress is the United States of America. I don't say that in a farcical way. I mean it seriously. I think companies have not been seriously concerned about liability for violating international law or extraterritorial application of international law, because they say to themselves, well, it's provided we jump through the State Department's hoops or export control qualities, there is no threat of any higher body of law having anything to say to us. And traditionally, that they've been right. What I would say is that international criminal law provides, I think, a much better language to couch this in than anything else, because international criminal law is much more powerful than anything else. And let me run you through a range of responses to why that's the case, culminating in the United States and China. In some instances, in Germany, for instance, which is one of the major arms manufacturers, the prosecutors have no discretion in bringing prima facie cases against arms vendors or anyone else. So if you can make out that there is a case, there is no discretion and the case must be brought against a German. It's different under universal jurisdiction. So suddenly there is this language and this legal construct which enables you to couch these cases and obviate, get beyond, dispense with prosecutorial discretion, which means that the opportunity for politics to overcome justice are much more limited. In places like France, for instance, there is the possibility of partie civile, and we see already, for instance, global witness initiating a case against a company involved in illegally exploiting natural resources in Liberia through partie civile, and something similar could happen through the arms trade. In fact, in Paris, the case AngolaGate, I'm not sure if people are familiar with AngolaGate, it was a case involving very high French politicians being held liable, admittedly not for international crimes, but being held liable for transferring weapons to Angola at the peak of a war. So in a peripheral sort of a sense, it's a precedent that's relevant to how this will function. In other countries that are part of the ICC, you will have a situation where there's real political pressure from the ICC structure to avoid being told you are unwilling to prosecute. And we see this play out, for instance, in Britain in the case I mentioned, where the British, I mean, very reluctantly, and countries don't generally prosecute their own soldiers for war crimes. It happens very seldom. But the British reluctantly prosecute their own soldiers for war crimes in Iraq. Well, my guess is that prosecuting their own companies for war crimes is much more palatable, or at least prosecuting business representatives is much more palatable than prosecuting your own soldiers. So that brings us to China and the United States. And as I say, I mean, those are traditionally difficult places, but my sense is that the culture is changing and that we should be as proactive as we can in changing that culture domestically. Potentially the Chucky Taylor prosecution here is a beginning, but it's easy to overestimate that change. Absent everything else, I think international criminal law is also a much more powerful language of protest than anything else. If I say, for instance, I think it's really bad what China is doing in Sudan, it carries moral weight, but the immediate reaction is, well, why is your moral opinion more relevant than anyone else's? Whereas I think if you can highlight in a technical legal sense that it's complicity in genocide or crimes against humanity, it carries a language of protest that I think China will be much more receptive to. It's not a perfect system we operate in, but my sense is that this particular lens might do more than others.
Thank you, James. Thanks to the... Oh, sorry. Do you really want to hear this?
Ready? Thank you, James. On behalf of OSI, and thanks to the fellowship team for organizing this. Very interesting. We will hopefully be getting news from you along the way and facilitating other contacts. And yes, we will ask you for predictions in 18 months. Hopefully they'll be easy to make at that point.
Hopefully.
Okay.
Thanks so much.